From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. Any way you look at it, and no matter how you feel about it, we have a big government in America. That may not surprise you, but the size and complexity of American government is surprising when set in historical context and measured against the 19th century's preference for small, local governance. The tension between a large public sector and strong anti-government sentiment is an important and very contemporary theme in American political life. My guest is Brian Ballow, Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian, welcome to Dialogue.
Glad to be here, George.
Brian, I suppose if the question is, how did we develop such a centralized conception of the state, it's probably best if we begin at or close to the beginning and sort of get a sense of the original premise of government here. And so let me put it to you this way, Brian. Looking back to the 19th century, where our story begins, what was the 19th century's ideal of government in this country? What did they want?
Well, I think that what they wanted was a government that would help Americans as individuals develop the nation's resources and use those resources productively. So we had a government, certainly in the mid portion of the 19th century, that was active, so to speak, in giving away the resources that the government already owned. And now I'm talking about the national level of government. We had a government that helped Americans as individuals and then eventually as corporations maximize the use of those resources. Now, those resources could be used in different ways, and the theme, at least in the middle part of the 19th century, was using them quickly. Yeah. Using them quickly did not necessarily mean that using them efficiently and certainly didn't mean using them in what, by today's standards, would be considered environmentally sound ways. But it did help Americans get to those resources, own them, use them, get them to market.
Which very nicely, Brian, leads me to my next question, because I as you spoke and depicted that for us very clearly, I began to think, well, given that, how do you begin to even get a move toward bigger, more complex government? A big growth in the public sector. And again, stimulated by your thoughts, I began to think, well, what is it? Is it industrialization? Is it modernization that begins at that point that begins to make layers of government more numerous and more complex? But what is it, Brian?
Well, I think there are a number of answers. The first is pretty prosaic, but pretty consistent, and that's war. The experience of the Civil War is one that provides a tremendous catalyst in terms of people experiencing what larger scale organization can do and what more centralized organization can do. Now, the Civil War system of delivering munitions, of administering the various things it had to do to conduct a war, the Northern system, which is the winning system, is quickly dismantled. But that experience remains an important event in the public memory in terms of how to tackle problems in the future. And when I said it's consistent in the sense that World War I and then World War II, moving ahead in our story, again, provide real catalytic spurts of the centralization and organization of government. So that's one part of the answer. I think a second factor that has been consistent is, you had mentioned earlier the importance of industrialization, and along with industrialization came organization into kind of corporate form on the part of businesses, particularly by the end of the 19th century. and the emergence of what today we call interest groups, trade associations, economic interest groups, whether they be representing farmers or industrialists or eventually professions. Even history professors are organized today. These groups, while many of them, particularly in the private sector, pursued a rhetoric that was stridently anti-big government, all appreciated larger government when it came to making their segment of the world a more orderly, more organized, more predictable place. So the source for many of the regulations that we ultimately got, the source for many of the government programs that we got, be they agricultural programs or be they programs in the Department of Commerce that Herbert Hoover was associated with, came from big business or big agriculture or even smaller agriculture. In other words, they came from the private sector, that very private sector that we associate with anti-government feeling. I think the third source of how we got big government, and the source that I'm really actively working on researching here at the Wilson Center, is skilled political bureaucrats in combination with politicians as well, who were able to convince large numbers of Americans that their particular programs met a deeply felt cultural need of whatever period we're looking at. They were able to sell their programs in terms that resonated at a very deep level with Americans. Perhaps the easiest example to give is the whole set of programs that increased the size of the national government that came out of the Cold War era. We simply accepted on faith the notion that we needed a civil defense system, that we needed a stronger military system, and eventually, even moving away from direct national security, we accepted that we needed a more sophisticated and complex educational apparatus to train experts in order to compete with the Soviet Union.
As we're talking, Brian, about the growth of government over a period from something small to something much bigger that we know today, at what point would you, as an historian, say, aha, now we have big government? I mean, where do we say we are now big? World War II.
Well, I would stretch World War II through the Korean War or even Sputnik, only because this is counterfactual, it's speculative, but my guess is that without the Cold War, and not just the Cold War in military terms, but what I would call the second phase of the Cold War, which involved the race for international prestige, triggered by Sputnik, the notion that the Soviets were getting ahead of us in technology, exacerbated by the notion that there was a space race, the notion that the Russians were going to beat us to the moon, all part of the Cold War. But getting the moon first doesn't have anything directly to do with military security. It has to do with international prestige. I would say that if we did not have that Cold War, then it's very possible that the United States might have returned to a smaller central government in the immediate wake of World War II. So you asked me when, I would say, you know, sometime between 45 and 57. And after 57, I think you not only have the institutionalization of a military apparatus and strong government in that regard, you have all kinds of domestic programs that are really looking at the growth of these national security programs as models, models for selling the importance of their presence to the American public.
You know, again, listening and thinking about our conversation, our topic, Brian, I keep, for some reason, returning to this notion of natural phenomenon. Maybe it's the idea of growth. Maybe that's what's doing it in my mind. But that leads me to think about climate, you know, ambiance and all the things that surround the phenomenon as it develops. And I began to think, the way the society is developing and the way that different forces within society are maturing may have an effect on this too. And let me try to be more specific. I'm wondering, for example, the extent to which Americans become avid consumers, particularly after World War II, the way our media, television, radio, and that kind of thing also blossom in their own ways, the effect of these on other things on what we're talking about.
Well, I think you raise a very good point. The impact of consumption on the growth of the national government is something that I have not worked out in my own mind. But I think there's an important relationship there. One of the questions that I'm going to try to work out, actually in the next book I work on, I don't kind of given up hope of working it out for this book, is whether Americans, as they become more consumption-oriented, also view their government in a more consumerist way. Do they, to use the vernacular of the market, are they looking for kind of policy products, policy goods? Do politicians feel compelled to provide new and innovative policies to a demanding public the way marketers in the private sector understand that they need to update and upgrade shopping malls if, in fact, they're going to retain the same clientele? We do know from political scientists that politicians, after World War II, increasingly build careers in policy terms by becoming associated with national policies that are tied to national interest groups and move away from their older links to political party or to local constituencies. We happen to have the perfect example of that in the headlines these days. That's Dan Rostenkowski, who came out of an old school Chicago Democratic machine and perhaps was done in by some of those older techniques, but in fact made a name in politics by being associated with national policy initiatives as head of House Ways and Means.
I think that's an excellent point. I really encourage you to look into that, because there is a as we both said before, a sort of unreality about a lot of the political debate in our society, and there is an antagonism in the public against big government, but then also there's an appetite for all the things that big government does.
Yes. You know? Well, this, I think, really does go back to one of those causes that I mentioned a little earlier in our conversation, and that is part of the growth of government is explained very directly by well-organized interest groups lobbying for expansion of that part of the government which they need to expand in order to achieve their ends.
Yeah.
And none of us ever have a problem with the part of big government that is serving us directly. It's only the other parts that account, we argue, account for 99% of our taxes that we're really not so crazy about. So I would be the last to argue that funding for the Woodrow Wilson Center should be cut back, certainly not while I have a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship. Others out there might wonder how necessary this is.
Since you touched on this point, and because of your background and your discipline, I'd love to get your opinion on the costs or dangers of what we're talking about here, particularly the fact of the special interest groups driving so much of the process now.
Well, I think you'll be surprised by the answer. I think that clearly there are dangers in organized interest groups in being too greedy, in thinking only of their own needs, not thinking of the larger public good. On the other hand, I have kind of a market view, or in more formal terms, I do subscribe to a pluralist view of American politics. I think overall, if there's a fair combat between a broad variety of interest groups, I think interest groups can be a very good way of representing the needs of various publics. I don't think we're a nation that is one public. I think we are a nation of many publics. I think that interest groups can at times fairly represent a whole variety of needs. And I'll go farther. I'll say I'm deeply distrustful of a set of godlike figures, whether they be a natural aristocracy or a bunch of people with PhDs, or just popular politicians who we say you decide the public good. Yeah. I actually think that the clash of interest groups is not a bad way to work out the needs of America's various publics.
There is so much to talk to you about, Brian. I want to turn us in the direction also of the very human aspect of this story, the question of leadership and the influence of individuals at certain points as this develops and what they were able to do. Before that, though, let me take a moment just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Brian Ballow, Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and a current fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. Brian Ballow was educated at Harvard and Johns Hopkins Universities. He's the author of Chain Reaction, Expert Debate and Public Participation in American Commercial Nuclear Power, 1945 to 1975, which was published by Cambridge Press in 1991. Brian, as we both were talking earlier, this is at the root very much a human drama when you get down to it, and largely therefore a question of leadership, specifically skilled administrators in certain instances in our history, building the case, I guess, for larger government interest. I'd like to contrast two figures that I know that you are studying intensely as you're writing your current book. One at the end of the 19th century, sort of turn of the 20th, and then one sort of at mid-century point. And the 19th century figure I have in mind is the well-known, perhaps almost legendary figure, Gifford Pinchot, the conservationist. I know a lot could be said, but if you had to sort of briefly characterize how he acted in this question and what he did to perhaps make government bigger, I'd appreciate that.
Okay. I think the first thing that Pinchot did was he understood, he lived, he felt, and he translated into his public rhetoric, the pulse of the nation. I think he understood that Americans wanted their government, particularly their national government, to aid in the more efficient use of resources. Pinchot came to office at a time that Americans were obsessed with the closing of the frontier, beginning to engage far more broadly in international trade, becoming familiar with large-scale corporations, with economies of scale. And I think Pinchot understood in two ways that Americans had a need to use resources that had seemed overwhelmingly abundant, that now seemed to be scarcer, to use those resources more efficiently. Pinchot was a very religious man in his early childhood, and I think he felt personally the need to use God's resources more fruitfully, mm-hmm. The notion of stewardship, mm-hmm. as did many millions of Americans at the end of the 19th century. We were a deeply religious Protestant nation at the time. But I think he also understood the writings of economists who were beginning to talk about maximizing productivity, right. using resources more efficiently. Yeah. And I think that understanding of efficiency was the bridge from the religious to the more modern political economy of the 20th century. So I think framing questions in those terms, even questions that might have seemed narrow to some, what do you do about trees, mm-hmm. framing them in the larger terms of conserving America's resources, using them efficiently, was a big part of his success. Pinchot understood that it wasn't enough to have a kind of vague, that it was important for millions of Americans to resonate with his rhetoric, that you needed kind of a general goodwill out there. But that wasn't enough. You needed identifiable, well-organized interest groups who would be there day in and day out, lobbying for your position, lobbying legislatively and lobbying administratively.
So this
So in today's jargon, Pinchot knew how to work outside the Beltway in terms of appealing. If, you listeners, I don't want you to feel there was a Beltway in 1898, but he knew how to work outside the Beltway in terms of broader appeals that reached some of the other things that Americans cared about. Americans hated big government in Pinchot's days, but that's not all they thought about. They had other needs, other cares. But Pinchot also knew how to work very effectively inside the Beltway.
Using your metaphor, inside the Beltway, and thinking of Washington of our time and of the fairly recent past, I'd love for you to contrast the Gifford Pinchot style of leadership on environmental questions and on questions of government action with that of James Webb and of NASA, because now this is a story, this is a very modern story, the story of NASA and how it gets to be the size it is and have the place it does have in the American psyche.
Yeah, I think that the best way to contrast the two is to say that Pinchot worked through very personal mechanisms. He worked through his personal relationship with Teddy Roosevelt, which was really quite extraordinary. He worked through his personal connections to these private sector interest groups. He used his own personal wealth to really create the profession of forestry. Pinchot, and one of the reasons I am looking at him, was really kind of in on the ground floor of building America's bureaucratic state. So he literally needed to create many of the things that 60 years later, James Webb could take for granted. Pinchot had to create a profession. There were no foresters in America. He used his personal wealth to endow the Yale School of Forestry. You contrast that with Webb, who was also very interested in profession building and building America's universities. Webb's agenda was to steer an already large and complex university system after World War II, to steer that towards some of the states and geographic locations that had been left out. So Webb's, one of his major goals in life was to not just use physicists and engineers from MIT and Harvard and Caltech, but to begin to develop programs at universities like Oklahoma State in order to spread the wealth of America's professional and university complex.
Yeah.
So what I'm getting at is Pinchot had to work in a very direct, personal, and immediate way to create some of the building blocks of America's bureaucratic state. By the time Webb arrived on the scene, first as budget director immediately after World War II, and then in his role in NASA and the race to the moon in the 1960s, Webb had to begin to steer and make use of what by now was a very complex policy-generating system.
Again, that's a very helpful answer. And what came through to me was this, that given the competence, the zeal, and whatever one wants to say in addition about the individual characteristics of these two remarkable figures, they each understood their society and their times fundamentally.
Absolutely. And I think that's the key to, as we've talked about, there are a lot of factors in how we got big government. But when you're looking at the role of individuals, when you're saying, wait a second, this doesn't happen automatically. In fact, it happens because certain individuals have certain talents and skills. Then I think that's the most crucial.
Yeah.
People think of bureaucrats as good managers. They probably conceive of them as kind of having incredibly well-organized desks and lots of paper clips, and they know how to write memos. In fact, really effective political bureaucrats start by understanding the pulse of the nation, just the way a good elected official would.
Brian, to conclude a conversation that I frankly have enjoyed immensely, I wanted to bring our story right up to today, and this may not be the right way to do it, but this did occur to me that thinking of an issue that poses or is likely to pose many of the same kinds of issues and possibilities and even unintended consequences of the sorts of things we've been talking about, it occurred to me that the healthcare debate may have a lot of that involved in it for a couple of reasons. One is it deals with a felt need. I think there is a national mood for this. It's got articulate leadership all over the place on various points of view, and of course, fervent lobbies and interest groups involved. So I guess I'd like to ask you in conclusion, and I know this could be the subject of a separate conversation altogether, but just in kind of a brief sense, what do you think, from what you've studied and are studying, are the parallels and the lessons and the kinds of cautions we all might be well advised to take into this debate?
I think that's a great question. I think that if we consider what we've talked about over the last half hour or so, there are some things missing if we were to expect a successful conclusion the quest for national health care. There has been no war. There is no sense of larger external crisis, one of the factors we talked about. On the other hand, I think we should look at the constellation of interest groups, and there's a tendency to view the interests arrayed against healthcare and say this is a formidable group. This will not happen. And certainly as an historian, it would be foolhardy to look back at the various, at the wreckage of past efforts for national health care and ignore that. And there have been a number of attempts, all of them unsuccessful. But what we forget are the very well-organized interests arrayed on behalf of national health care. And now I'm talking about some of the very same large industrial interests that we've been talking about for this half hour. Corporate America wants to eliminate some of the competition from smaller scale businesses that are not paying for health care. I remember watching the debate in Massachusetts over Dukakis's health care plan, and some of the biggest supporters were some of the biggest corporations. They were already paying for health care. They had no problem with the state of Massachusetts picking this up, passing the cost on to some of their competitors. So I think that you can score one for national health care in terms of large-scale interests that might be supporting it. So in the terms of this discussion, I think much of this does come down to the personal effort on the part of those who are trying to connect with these deeply felt needs on the part of the American public. And I think that, in fact, Hillary Clinton is the, while she holds no bureaucratic post, she is not an elected official. She is in charge of much of this policy. And I think she is the Gifford Pinchot or the James Webb of this formula. And I think much of the success or failure of the program might come down to her ability and her skills. And I can't predict how that's going to come out.
Yeah, but she's already helped us a lot to understand how it's going on. Brian Ballow, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. This has been fun.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Brian Ballow, Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the Radio Store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.
RI, Public Radio International.